Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of July 2019. Welcome to episode 50 of this podcast series, which means we've been doing this for half a century. No, wait, that doesn't sound right. Nevertheless, the concept of the show is to just have a brief chat about what comics I've read since the last time we had one of these brief chats, which should make this more or less, pretty much, kind of, the books I read during July. Now, these books are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, and I regularly repost those on my Facebook and Twitter, so you can find those, but those posts aren't exactly spoilers for this podcast, since those are just lists. And here, there's a little more review, a little more critique, a little more discussion. But first, a little feedback. On an episode from a couple of months back, DragonCon's Michael Bailey had a comment related to... guess. Come on, guess. The Super Family of books, that's right! How'd you guys know? I talked about issues of Superman where Clark and John ended up on Dinosaur Island. And Mike pointed out that in the Superman special that DC published before Bendis took over, they returned safe and sound from the island. Now, Mr. Bailey also posted on Facebook about a situation that I mentioned a few months ago. Professor Allen talked about some comics from Innovation, and he made a very subtle allusion to the fact that most of the women are drawn as if they're not wearing support undergarments and were always very cold. I've gone through 3 issues of Hero Alliance End of the Golden Age and the first 2 issues of the ongoing Hero Alliance, and I have to say, the professor wasn't lying. It's a thing. Well, I appreciate that affirmation. And I appreciate David S. Gutierrez's confirmation of that circumstance as well. And of course, he also talked about the council, a group of podcasters who get together whenever Mike fails to watch a comic book movie, and then we... well, perhaps I've said too much. And Ed Moore from Teal Productions had a few things to say about a few of the Boom books that we've talked about recently here on this show. I've been a fan of the Hero Squared universe since the Boom miniseries, because Giffen and DeMatteis were attached to it. He also recommended tracking down the Boombox mixtape books. The 2014 issue has a Midas Flesh story, and the 2018 issue reprints that. So interesting. Thank you, Ed. That last episode received social media love from Mike Peacock from Justice's First On, Comic Reflections, Sean from Secret Wars and Beyond, Mr. Dystopia, Paul Heeks, Chris Ouellette, Gene Hendricks, Derek William Crabb of the Fanholes Podcast, Al Sedano, Collected Edition, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Billy D, Sanity's Last Chance, Karen from Between the Pages, and Liz Ann Oswalt, who has a YouTube channel. Thanks for the supports, everybody. And now, on to the books that I read last month, as I do for this show. I'm categorizing the books that I read. And first are the books that I read specifically for podcast appearances. These are the homework books. For Quarterbin 139, I read Marvel Superheroes Magazine, number 4. And for our Shortbox Showcase Anniversary episode, episode 66, I read Detective Comics 1000. For an upcoming appearance on Back to the Bins, I brought a book that was given to me by the great Kansan Greg Arujo, New York, Year Zero, number 4, and Dragon Con's Michael Bailey brought to the show Valor, number 1. And for future guest appearances on a couple of podcasts that haven't recorded yet, and I don't know when they'll record or be released, so I'm going to be kind of vague, But for those, I read a lot of books. Batgirl 12, Batman 216, Batman 587, Batman Gotham Knights 13, Birds of Prey 27, Catwoman 90, Detective Comics 393 and 754, Justice League of America 75 and 76, Nightwing 53, and Robin 86. And on the new comics that we read right off the shelves, Adventures of the Super Sons, number 12. This wraps up the series in a very, very satisfying way. This was a fun and entertaining book, and the finale lived up to that. Our heroes are heroically victorious, and at the end, despite their heroic victory, they find that the worst thing possible, as boys of certain ages, has occurred to them. They've missed the whole summer, and school is right around the corner. Justice League Dark, number 12. In addition to the ongoing battles between the Lords of Order and Chaos, we also get the backstory of how Wonder Woman came to be the leader of this team. Batman isn't sure that a Justice League of the Dark is a good idea, and he's curious why a heavy hitter like her would choose to lead it. And I liked her answer. We want the things in the dark to fear us. Speaking of Wonder Woman 73 and 74, first of those, 73 is largely a fill-in issue with a guest writer, guest penciler, guest inker. What it is a Hippolyta versus Hippolyta battle with Diana saving the day. But mostly we end up with the Amazons, who went missing many issues ago, many writers ago. If my memory serves, they're coming back. And then 74 is the last of the series that I'm going to read. I enjoyed it a lot at the beginning, but the last few creative teams hasn't connected with me all that much. But I'm certainly glad that we put it on our list from the start of the Rebirth era. And I got to say, 74 straight issues for us, that's a pretty huge, long run. I also started getting a DC book a few months ago, a reboot of a concept I've covered a bunch on various shows, here and on the Quarter Bin in particular, but I purposely saved them up so I could read them sort of handfuls at once, which kind of defeats the purpose of buying single issues if you're going to treat them as if you're waiting for the trade, but hey, don't judge me. And that book was Dial H for Hero 1 through 4, from Bendis' Wonder Comics line. Our hero Miguel is in a dead-end job working at a mayonnaise-themed food truck. And then he meets a girl known around town for always running away, and the two of them, they run away. And then when things go crazy for Miguel, he finds an old-school dial telephone. Actually, he is found by the telephone. And his contact, the operator, tells him to dial H. And he does. And anytime he does, he becomes a new one-off hero with a bizarre costume, name, and power set. Eventually, we meet past dialers, including DC superstars Snapper Carr and Robbie Sakamaji Reed. We have lost the reader contributions in this version of Dial H, but these characters are insane. How much of this is writer Sam Humphries? How much is the art of Joe Quinones? That I don't know. But folks like Monster Truck, Chimp Change, the Zonky King, they certainly are congruent with the spirit of old Dial H, at least the Adventure Comics run from the early 80s with Chris King and Vicky Grant that I covered a bunch of over on the Quarter Bin. This is darker, this is more modern, but I think more or less that I liked it. And from the good folks at Alterna, providers of comics at the awesome price of $1.50, I read Unit 44, number 3. In this series, a pair of less than competent government workers have let loose an alien artifact from Area 51. And as a result, this alien's race is coming to Earth. And not as friends, by the way, but as conquerors. I like that this has a lot of silliness in it, some slapstick moments at the expense of the federal government workers, which is fine by me. But we end with the aliens arriving, prepared to conquer, and seemingly able to as well. And we only have one more issue to keep that from happening. And then on to the general comic book reading that I did. And we start with some of the comics I recently received from the newest member of the hashtag comic book circle of life. What happened was that I was not at HeroesCon this year. I have gone to HeroesCon before, and you may not know this, but Paul Hicks has as well. But an internet and podcasting friend posted a picture for me that the best deals that he had found so far at the con were 50-cent boxes. Now, I brag that I found, with Luke Giaconetti's help, 5 for $1 boxes when I went last year, and I wished him luck. And later, this friend did post that he'd found some quarter bins. Victory. I joked, seriously, I was joking, that since I couldn't make it, maybe he could send me some of those books. And because, despite what the irredeemable Shag always says about this guy, Derek William Crabb of the Fanholes podcast and the epic History of Comics on Film YouTube series, Derek sent me some of those comics, including Legion of Superheroes Annual 2 from 1986. This one features Validus on a mission for his father Darkseid to eliminate the original 3 Legionnaires. It's a high-stakes story, and it's worthy of the extra length that the annual affords. And of course, we know that's not always the case, but it is a pleasant reading experience when it is. And for this one, and I'm biased because I was still into the Legion big time at this point when this annual came out, but this one, I think it really does tell a story worthy of those extra pages, and it does definitely make use of those extra pages that the annual affords. And Derek sent Wonder Man number 1 from 1991, which was written by a recently incarcerated comic book professional. That's all I'm going to say about that. I like the concept of Wonder Man more than the execution, though when I think about execution, I think about that comic book writer. But anyway, but for the most part, like I say, I like the concept of Wonder Man. Now, part of that is probably just my general lack of Marvel knowledge, because all of the connections that Simon has, the backstory, all of that deep history is sort of lost on me. And Superman, Our Worlds at War, Secret Files and Origins. I can see how this may have come in very handy at the time when the Our Worlds at War event was what was happening at the time for DC. But now it's a little more than a historical artifact. It's a well-done artifact, this book. It's kind of interesting. But really, it is little more than an artifact at this point. And of course, because it's Derek, he also sent Transformers Generation 1, number 1. And let me take this opportunity to discuss my entire history with the Transformers. And I'm talking live action, movies, toys, the TV show, and of course these comics. So here is my Transformers history. So with that massive background with the franchise, an issue 1 is probably a good place for me to start with. And this one did lay the groundwork well enough that I think I'm pretty sure I knew what was happening most of the time, who our main characters were, what the conflict was, and maybe by the end of the issue, where the whole storyline may be going. Thank you, Derek, for your generosity. Appreciate that. In my area here in Central Ohio, there's a guy who has what he calls comic book garage sales on a regular basis, but it's basically a retail store in his house. I'm just going to call him Mr. B, because I'm not sure how his neighbors would feel about him actually running a business out of his house in a nice suburban neighborhood. And let me just say that Mr. B appears to be somewhat casual about the collection of sales tax. So he has a few individually priced books, what would sort of be wall books, but mostly he just has dozens of long boxes that are usually priced at $1 apiece. But I went over there recently for the first time because it was a buy one, get one sale, or for practical purposes, a 50-cent sale. And I picked up a few things there, such as Strange Adventures 227, which is a self-proclaimed gigantic issue, 7 startling stories of super science fiction. The bummer was only one Adam Strange story, and I'll be honest, it wasn't all that great. Most of the other stories were average-ish, but the issue was saved by the last story reprinted, The King of New Orleans, featuring the awesome epicness of the Atomic Knights. This story reminded me that I have the Great Disaster showcase on my shelves, and it reminded me that maybe I had to pull that off the shelf sometime this summer or autumn. Last month, I talked about reading book one of a 2-part miniseries and that I wasn't interested in really finishing up the series. And then I found, in those 50-cent boxes, Justice Inc. Book 2, Betrayal. And I couldn't resist. I had the same problems with Kyle Baker's art as I did in the first one, in that it was experimental and interesting, but just didn't work for me. At least in this one, the story got more interesting. The Avenger uses his face-changing powers and his anger at the U.S. and the Allies that during the Cold War, he goes from small country to small country, takes the place of their leadership, leads anti-American rebellions, and ends up changing the world. It's an interesting take on the disenchanted spy, similar to the stuff that John Le Carré was so good at putting in his novels. Digging through my books recently, I noticed that one that I had missed in my recent Read All My Techno Comics Issues process. So I read Lady Justice number 4. In this one, we start a totally new storyline with a new woman receiving the Spirit of Justice, a teenager in a gang-infested neighborhood, and I'm starting to think that this Lady Justice spirit is not all that friendly. I'm thinking combination of the Punisher and the Spectre, and you're pretty close to what's happening in this series. And from Dr. Anthony the Engineer, I read Croak number 1, the start of a 3-issue series from Alterna from 2017. And it's not a bad little suspense slash horror tale. At least that's how it's presented here in the first issue. There may be more to it than that, but what we have in this first issue is a band of teens camping in a strange location where strange things have supposedly happened, and surprise, a strange thing or two does appear to happen to them. And just randomly popping around the DC Universe app, I read Detective Comics 418 and 451. I picked them sort of at random because, as a completionist, I knew if I'd started reading consecutively at some point, I'd never stop. So 418 is a creeper story in which Jack Ryder finds himself unable to transform back to a civilian identity, stuck as the crazy-looking and kind of crazy creeper. I've always been fascinated by the creeper, back from seeing him in books from this era. This one also featured a reprint from 1948, a story featuring Sierra Smith, Western detective. And that was, surprisingly, kind of a fun read. In Detective 451, Bruce and his rich friends are on a Caribbean island, and danger is in the air because of the international backgammon tournament. Now look, I've played my fair share of backgammon and its close friend, AC Ducey, and I can honestly never recall the time when international criminals stormed a tournament. Oh, right, except that one time in the Caribbean back in 1975. Oh, no, wait, that was just in this comic, sorry. And there's also a ski tournament subplot. Now, that's not exactly Caribbean, but it involves some of the same high rollers. Crazy story, and more or less pretty fun. And some kid books that I read, some from Sir Rob Lance's care package, some from the Cheap Bin, some from Ron Sadowski. I read Jughead 196, Popeye and Transportation Careers, Popeye and Office and Business Careers, Archie and Me 156, The Funky Phantom number 3, Betty and Veronica Spectacular 15, and Archie's Double Digest 139 and 286. I was really excited about finding a stack of Archie Digests at Pulp Reality for 50 cents, and I really enjoyed reading those Double Digests until, you know, a few days later when I saw that the yard sale artist, Jared Albrecht, scored about 10 of these digests from a library book sale for a quarter each. Yes, I am still a bit jealous, but also, Jared is my new hero. I mean, he was already kind of a hero with the military service and organizing Comics for Courage, putting up for this long with Pat Sampson on the Long Box Crusade. But finding 25-cent Archie Digests, that just pushed Jared over the heroic edge in terms of my definitions. Now, The Funky Phantom was basically a Scooby-Doo knockoff, except that instead of Shaggy, they had the ghost of a Revolutionary War leader as part of the team, and his ghost of a cat. And the two Popeye books about careers were part of about a 10-issue series from the early 70s, and these two were amazing. Created to be distributed at schools, I assume, these explained various roles, in one case, in an office, receptionist, file clerk, accountant, and the other covered transportation careers like school bus drivers, air traffic controllers, taxi drivers, and even airline pilot. The info that was in there was obviously dated, but they were kind of an interesting time capsule, I thought. There is an old saying about being a radio personality that certainly applies to being a podcaster, and that is that you go into this line of work for three reasons: to help your friends, to crush your enemies, and get free stuff. And I don't really have any enemies, and I hope I've helped my friends, but we all know that this show in particular is evidence about that final part, about how great it is to get free stuff. Of course, that's mostly from lovely listeners, many of whose names you've heard already in this episode or in past episodes for sure. But I also, and rarely to be sure, but I do get approached by creators who offer free stuff in exchange for a review. And what I tell anyone who makes that offer is that I talk about every comic I read on this podcast, no matter how I feel about that comic, good, bad, or indifferent. I will be honest. And to be honest, after hearing that standard reply from me, a number of creators choose to not follow up with that and not send their comics for review. But when I gave that answer a month or so ago to the mysterious personage behind the Not Lev Gleason Twitter account, they were not fazed and sent me a copy of Not Daredevil number 1. This is a pretty cool idea. I've got to start there. What this book is doing is taking public domain comics from the 40s and 50s from Lev Gleason Publishing and then replacing all of the dialogue to tell a new story. As it says on the cover, classic Golden Age heroes recontextualized for a modern audience. In this case, it's Daredevil, the guy from back in the day with the half-red, half-blue suit, that Daredevil. And it tells a modern-ish version of a story that was drawn and paneled and produced 60-some years ago. And it does so in a way that comments upon, with humor, the attitudes of that less enlightened era, shall we say. I think it's a great idea, and it is an impressive creative accomplishment to work within existing panels and characters and storytelling and do something totally different while commenting on the original? It's like I said, it's a cool idea. And here it's done quite well. Some of the jokes didn't hit me personally, but that's a matter of taste. And that doesn't detract from the impressive accomplishment that I think this book is. So check out the Twitter feed. It's at Lev_Gleason or levgleason.blogspot.com. Free copies of this issue are readily available through those sites. All right, time to take a break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about the graphic novels and trade paperbacks and long runs that I read during July.
Hello, campaign junkies. This is Mike Murphy. Imagine you're out on the campaign trail and you walk into a bar stuffed with the traveling show of American politics, reporters, candidates, staff. You pull up an empty bar stool. You turn and see sitting next to you and ready to talk politics is David Axelrod, President Obama's famed political advisor and longtime political consultant.
And Mike Murphy, the brains behind John McCain's brilliant 2000 Straight Talk Express campaign and a veteran of, what is it, about a million campaigns, other campaigns?
Yeah. Too many campaigns, but all fun, including some campaigns won and lost against the great David Axelrod. We've been friends for a long time, and we talk politics between ourselves about what's really going on the telephone or when we see each other.
Then we thought maybe other people would like to hear these conversations. And so we got the idea for Hacks on Tap.
And the reason we're going to be watching the early campaign and beyond so carefully is the process defines the candidates.
Yeah, you know, Mike, I always thought that presidential campaigns were a little like NASA, in that you could be in the simulator, you can write about it, you can talk about it, but unless you've been up in orbit, you don't really understand what a presidential campaign is, the G-forces and all the different challenges that you face, and what you should take seriously and what you should not.
We're going to talk about what's really going on, what you don't really hear in the media from people who've been there and seen it and know all the inside dope. It's going to be funny, interesting, irreverent, and once in a while, we're even going to have a great guest, a real hack who might even have been elected to something. So if you want to get the real inside ride on the campaign trail, give us a try on all your podcast platforms.
Hacks on Tap.
Subscribe today.
And we're back to talk about trades, long runs, and miniseries that I read last month. And I'm going to start with a trade that I pulled off the library shelves for a simple reason. A single word. A single four-letter word. D-O-O-M. So I read all of Black Panther, Doom War, which was made up of Black Panther 7 through 12, Doom War 1 through 6, and Claws of the Panther 1 through 4. This is when Shuri has taken over for T'Challa as the leader of Wakanda, and a certain visionary leader from Central Europe thinks that maybe this would be a good time to invade, to negotiate better terms for vibranium for his small but proud country. And if it involves framing Namor for certain violent acts, you gotta crack a few eggs, you know what I'm saying? Doom actually managed to nab all of the vibranium in Wakanda, including getting through the final lock that it was hidden behind, which was a test of character and honesty. And of course, folks like the Panthers and the Failure Four assumed that this would stop him, seeing as under the influence of hashtag Big Comic, they view him as, you know, evil and inherently deceitful. But at that portal, Doom sheds his armor and communes naked with the Panther God and reveals the truth that deep down we all know, that the only possible future in which the world survives is Doom World. And the Panther God realizes that this is the truth, and therefore lets him in. Now, I would suggest that people stop reading the trade at this point around issue 3 of Doom War, as the quote-unquote editors at Big Comic get involved at this point and spin a fanciful version of the tale in which Doom is defeated? And then, I don't get this at all. This Black Panther trade then moves into four issues of a miniseries that doesn't feature Doom at all? They just include, like, characters from the Black Panther world? I don't get it. Do they not want to sell comics? Actually, I do take that back. They do want to sell comics, which is probably why in this miniseries, Shuri teams up with both Shanna the She-Devil and then Wolverine in order to track down some new strains of vibranium. So, like a lot of Doom-related stories, this is very good for the first 80% or so. The Doom characterization is really good, actually, and the scene at the locked door is pretty terrific. Well done. Except for the last, 100 pages or so of the collection where it goes totally off the rails. Definitely goes downhill from that point. Now, I read a bunch of books in a general genre of the adventure story, whether that's caveman era, jungle adventures, or that kind of book. And we start with a famous pulp era hero, Tarzan. 7 through 10, this is from the Dark Horse run from 1996. I picked these up from Pulp Reality at 50 cents each, and did so because this made up an entire storyline, Legion of Hate. And it was pretty interesting. It was set during World War II, and featured a Nazi soldier who has stumbled across a magic emerald in Africa, which gives the possessor great powers. There are the expected racial issues and tensions in the story, but there are also a bunch of unexpected racial issues and tensions in here as well. There's one African tribe of women who only want to mate with white men. And when they capture Tarzan, they have to decide if he is white or not, or white enough for their purposes. And then you have Tarzan's best buddy, the black African man Mugambi. And after they beat back the Nazis, spoilers, Mugambi tells Tarzan that revolution is coming, and that one day, they may end up on different sides of a war in Africa. Tarzan doesn't think of himself as white, especially when white is the same as Nazi. But he knows that he's not a black African either, and is in fact an English landowner in Africa, which, as Mugambi points out, will certainly make them enemies. Eventually. And this actually ties into one of the themes that Edgar Rice Burroughs wanted to explore in the character of Tarzan, and that is the nature and nurture debate or conversation. And as Mugambi seems to be saying, however, Tarzan wishes to see himself. As far as the Africans are concerned, he is not one of them. And certainly anytime he hangs out with British aristocracy, they make it quite clear that he is not one of them either. Now, I admit that I was not expecting the nuance that I found in these issues, the many different ways that racial issues were discussed. Very interesting stuff. And from a little bit earlier, 1992, when Malibu held the license, I read Tarzan, Love, Lies, and the Lost City, 1 through 3. This one had Tarzan heading to the Lost City of Opar, in a series based on an Edgar Rice Burroughs story. And he goes up against Princess La, who just wants Tarzan to be her eternal lover. You know, no big deal. Except Tarzan loves Jane, and even in an alternate dimension, he doesn't want to cheat on her. Ain't that sweet? Opar is presented as a dimension that he and La and Jane can access when any of them are near each other. At least, I think that's what was happening. And I like the idea of putting a more modern sci-fi spin or explanation for the sort of classic adventure book Lost City scenario. I tweeted out a panel from this issue with a complaint because one of the issues color-coded the narrator boxes, and one of the characters, I think it was Jane, had black print against a dark green-gray box, which made it nearly impossible for my 50-plus-year-old eyes to read. And the fact that it was a cursive, handwriting-style font, that did not help. But to the extent that I could read the story, you know, the panels and dialogue that I could make out. It was a pretty interesting read. And I read a related book, literally a related character, that I picked up in a $6 for $1 sale. How about that? And it didn't have a cover, but Korak, Son of Tarzan 53, did have a dramatic lead story about the Son of Tarzan finding a tribe that was basically at a Stone Age level of technology, and he shows them modern ways of living, modern ways of warfare. And I read some issues from, I guess, a sort of a similar type of hero, the one more from the sword and sorcery corner of the world, from DC Comics from the early 70s, issues that I bought in a $3 for $1 box, Claw the Unconquered 9 and 10. There's actually an interesting story going on between these two issues, because literally between, like 18 months passed between these two issues, despite being numbered consecutively 9 and 10. The problem was that 9 ended with a cliffhanger, Claw versus Oculus, but the title was canceled after that issue, Hello, DC Implosion. Now, the guys behind that issue was Dave Michelinie and Keith Giffen, and they pushed for literally over a year to get the chance to finish up that story somewhere in an anthology, as a backup, anything. And then when Metal Men got the axe, a spot opened in the DC schedule, and Claw came back with issue 10, which was a bit of a fill-in to reintroduce readers to the character and to that ongoing story. But it only lasted two issues after that, and it took Canceled Comics Cavalcade and a couple of Warlord backups to finally bring the epic of Claw to a close. And courtesy of the generous Canadian Sir Rob Lance, I read Kazar the Savage 17 from Marvel from 1976, and I'm just going to say this about that. Gray-blue aliens firing energy guns from atop their flying sharks. Nuff said. And sort of related, I'm going to say, are Planet of the Apes magazines 2 and 22, which came to me courtesy of Mike Lane of Comics in the Golden Age and the Kirby Cast. These are oversized and are combinations of comic stories, and each issue had a couple of feature articles as well. And I really like the format, although it was kind of weird to read magazine-style articles and interviews on cheap newsprint with black and white photos. It seemed like a real misfit, like I wasn't really ready for that. But the interview with one of the screenwriters of the first Apes film was interesting. Also, the comic story in issue 22 was an interesting concept, as the story was designed to bridge the gap between conquest and battle. The comics in the early issue, number 2, was part of an adaptation of the original movie, and that was pretty good. Interesting reading experience, these two. But thanks, Mike. I really appreciated reading those. And in the spirit of the hashtag comic book circle of life, I sent those magazines on to one of the original of the two true freaks, Scott Gardner, who is a big fan of the Apes. And from the 50-cent boxes at Pulp Reality, I picked up a complete miniseries featuring a character that I'm liking more and more the more I read of her. Spider-Woman Origin, 1 through 5. This is from 2006, and we get the story of Jessica Drew's science parents, her mom not knowing that her dad was in fact Hydra, and his mission was to experiment on Jessica, who had accidentally gotten exposed to spider DNA in utero. In this, Jessica moves from Hydra to S.H.I.E.L.D., working with the David Hasselhoff version of Nick Fury. And Hydra doesn't like that much, and even her dad doesn't like that much, and much drama ensues. I'm pretty sure this is the first time I've read a book, certainly an extended run, with art from the Luna Brothers, and that gave the story a good look, different from classic standard comic book art, but effective and highly skilled art. Also from Pulp Reality, I picked up the entirety of a miniseries based on a successful series of fantasy novels, Michael Moorcock's Hawkmoon, Jewel in the Skull 1 through 4, and have never read any of Moorcock's novels, despite being a fan of fantasy fiction, although I did cover one briefly on an episode of Back to the Bins. M was the guest, and I believe they brought an issue from Elric. In this, Darian Hawkmoon was brought to Grand Breton after his country was defeated by the Dark Empire. A jewel is placed in his skull, which threatens to eat his brain if he doesn't follow instructions, but Count Brass enabled him to temporarily be freed of that spell, and he fought back. It's a story full of swords and knights and barons. All of the elements you expect in a fantasy epic. Seems like good source material, and Jerry Conway's script and Raphael Cannon's art delivered a solid action-packed series. I enjoyed these ones. Glad I found them there in the cheap bins. Now, of course, I've mentioned that one of the things I look for in cheap bins are square-bound books. For one thing, they're easy to identify from the top, right? You don't even have to pull them up out of the box to know what they are, at least what category they fall into. And if you can get an entire miniseries, like Legion of Night 1 and 2 from Marvel Comics from 1991, of course, you grab them. Now, this was written by Steve Gerber, so guess what? It was kind of weird. This was the story of a demonic cult that wished to raise a great beast from his sleep, a beast that turns out to be Fin Fang Foom, the dragon, to wreak havoc on the land and to, spread his seed through human women. It is up to a ragtag group led by Charles Blackwater, a.k.a. Omen. This squad, this Legion of Night, has to enter the dream world to stop the dragon. And yes, it was as horror-y and weird and creepy as all of that sounds. But an interesting read. I mentioned getting a nice box of comics recently from Derek William Crabb of the Fanholes podcast. In that, he included a bunch of Punisher issues, and I read a brief selection of those, Punisher 3, 8, 11, and 12, all of those from the late 1980s and all written by Mike Baron. I more or less enjoyed most of these, and not having read a lot of Punisher in my days, I was surprised by the variety of stories that occurred in these. Frank took it into his own hands to execute a criminal that the state of Utah keeps staying the execution of. And of significance is the first pages of issue 8, in which the combination of Will Spartaccio, Scott Williams, and Tom Orzechowski give us a page of Frank reading the Wall Street Journal. And the journal, it actually looks like the front page of a Wall Street Journal. The typeface, the columns, the nature of the pictures, all of those are pretty unique within the journal, and they are so darned accurate. Because we've all seen newspapers portrayed in comic books, and they don't look at all like newspapers. Headlines and photos are outrageously large, use abbreviations or just language that wouldn't be used in those settings. But this was really well done. Now, I'm a daily reader of the Wall Street Journal, so I know what it looks like. That may have been why this really stood out to me, but I've got to admit, that page really stood out to me. A few years ago, I picked up some Marvel UK books from the 90s. Back when World's Greatest Comics put their 25-cent books on sale for, hello, a dime each. I read some last year and grabbed another miniseries last month to read, Digitech 1 through 4. It's a pretty standard story of a guy getting caught up in a computer explosion and somehow getting converted, a la Dr. Manhattan, into a being of pure energy with computer-based electro powers. And Deathlok shows up in an issue there, having literally been faxed to England for the battle, which I'm sure was cutting-edge technology when the issues were first written. And there's a love story, and spoilers, the digital man and the fleshly woman walk off together into the sunset when it is all over. Now, I mentioned that 50-cent garage sale back in the first half of the show, and from there I picked up a bunch of random, albeit related issues, Action Comics 375, 415, 433, 455, and 521, all from the late 60s up into the early 80s. Now, issue 415 featured a Frankenstein riff all the way up to the misunderstood monster character. And the issue at least called out that similarity or hung a lantern on it with a Daily Planet article that compared the famous movie monster to the alien. So not only was it metatextual, I guess it was also textual. 455 had Superman teaming up with Green Arrow and Atom to battle Junkman. Not exactly the top-of-the-line opponent that Superman ought to be paired up against. And 521 had him meeting Mari McCabe, a.k.a. the Vixen, in a story that took Clark and Lana from Metropolis to Africa. That was a pretty good globe-spanning epic adventure. I also picked up the trade of a comic series I revisited last month and plan to read one trade of each month to get closer to getting caught up with it now that it's done. This is The Walking Dead 169 to 174. Now that the Whisperers have mostly been defeated, a team is sent out to find the community that Eugene had been chatting with. And at the end of the issue, that meeting goes rather badly. And Rick is still acting a little kooky after a recent major death, and Negan is actually behaving himself off on his own, crazy, but that is paralleling Rick, so it works. And for what it's worth, I love, love, love the fact that Kirkman ended the story at 193. Beyond the fact that I'll be able to not just get caught up, but actually wrap up, that I'm certainly looking forward to. But first off, whoever was expecting something at 200 just doesn't understand how Kirkman organizes his storylines and trades. The paperbacks are 6 issues, the hardcovers are 12, and most importantly, the compendia contain 48 issues. Remember that a major, major event, one of the big early deaths, occurred in issue 48, not 50, because 48 is the big ending point for the way he produces these books, just as an example, meaning that 192 would have been the end of the fourth collection. And at some point leading up to that, Kirkman realized he didn't have another 48 issues in him, which is what he would have been, in his mind, committing to. And he just decided to end it at 193, and I'm assuming that last compendium will include that final issue. So for me, again, good on you, Kirkman. I found myself at a store here in town that I rarely get to, and wandered through their back issues and found the end of a miniseries from last year, still at cover price, but since it's an Alterna book, that cover price was only $1.50, and I admit, in a moment of weakness, I gave in to that temptation and read Tinseltown 3-5. The series takes place in 1915 and tells the story of Abigail Moore, one of the first female police officers in Hollywood, and no surprise, beneath the glamour on the surface is a rotten heart full of greed, falsehoods, and corruption. This was a very enjoyable series, with some dark bits, both in the way that Moore is treated, and also the way that many women in the business are treated. The good thing is that Abigail can, for the most part, help the victims get justice, and although there is some darkness and rough stuff in the story, it ends, spoilers, on a couple of upbeat notes, and I put down issue 5 with a smile on my face. And from Hoopla, I read another trade in a series I've been working on, Grimm Fairy Tales 37-42. I've really enjoyed the last few trades, which have laid in a nice sense of overarching storyline and origins, which were most certainly not there in the first few trades. But lately, we've gotten backstory for Selah and Belinda and the Grimm book itself, or at least hints of past histories and the mysteries of their powers. I did notice that they're starting to move toward a range of miniseries as well, which has me worried a bit, because I like the world building, the sense of history, the sense of mystery, but I don't want it to get where I have to read a ton of extra trades and minis and side quests to make sense of the main story. Do those, but I'm hoping those don't become required reading for understanding the main title. But all that being said, I'm constantly surprised at how much I'm enjoying the storyline here and actually at how complex it's becoming. And when I talk about grim fairy tales, I have to talk about the art and remind folks that the interior art does not always reflect the cheesecake of the covers. You may remember I was very close to dropping the series last year, a few trades back, when the interior art started to get ridiculous. But that has been pulled back for the most part. Yes, there is the occasional gratuitous shot. And every woman in the book is unnaturally attractive. But the inside art is still just inside the line of what works for me. I also read the next trade of a series I've been reading recently from Lion Forge Comics, Summit 10 through 14. This continues the story of astronaut Dr. Valentina Resnick-Baker and her life in the aftermath of a strange event in space, one where she, at least for a while, manifested strange new powers. In prior storylines, Val had been hearing a voice in her head, and then eventually seeing a ghostly image of her dead teammate astronaut, Jamila Parks. But she's not quite dead. She's still around, or at least her molecules are. This was another book with a Dr. Manhattan-style character, I think. This was another fun trade, and the storyline actually wrapped up very satisfactorily. 14 ended up not being the last issue, but it's one of those things where it could have been. Then once another trade comes out, going up through issue 18 or 19 or 20, I'll probably read it. But it's nice to have the feeling that I don't have to read it, if you know what I mean. And I also picked up a Archie digital book from Hoopla, Pep Digital 96, B&V Friends, Pool Party, which, as you can probably imagine, takes place in the summer, and more specific than that, mostly at pool parties at the lodges. My favorite story was one about parent-child miscommunication, where Mr. Lodge is hosting a society event poolside on the same day that Ronnie is hosting her big summer blowout bash. And guess what? It all works out, and the generations get to know each other and even like and respect each other's differences. A good, fun story. And I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, Dial H was surprisingly strong. I enjoyed Tinseltown. Grimm was fun. That gigantic issue of Strange Adventures was a nice read. The Summit continues to be solid. But in terms of what I thought was the best, look, I read a miniseries that focused on Doom, so this really isn't a surprise, right? But that scene with Doom and the Panther God, it was the most awesome scene I read last month. And that occurred in my favorite comic of the month, Doom War number 3. Now next month, I'm going to knock out another Walking Dead trade. Although again, at some point, I'm going to catch up with when the trades have been released, and I might actually have to wait a little while to get to the ending, I suppose. And also, towards the end of July, I got a huge box of comics from the generous Canadian Sir Rob Lance. Technically speaking, that box of comics was so big, it was two boxes of comics, full of kids' books, miscellaneous other stuff, and a nice selection of this year's free Comic Book Day books, ones that I hadn't picked up on the day. So I plan to read a ton of those books, so get used to hearing Rob's name, that's all I'm saying. But whatever I do end up reading, I will be here to talk about the books I read in August, and that episode ought to be out sometime in early September. Feel free to let me know what you think of the episode, what you think of any of these books that I mentioned, especially if you've read them. You can send that feedback via email at relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or as a comment on the Facebook and blog post for this episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can follow the network on Twitter at relatively_geek. And, of course, the network has its own page on Facebook as well. Come join us. All are welcome. Thanks for listening, and keep the pages turning.